Welcome back to the Film Experience. You're here with your hosts, Nathaniel and Murtada.
Hello.
And we have three new movies to discuss today. Two in limited release and one wide, which is winning the box office this weekend, Ford v. Ferrari. So I thought we'd start there. Vroom, vroom.
Let's do it. Christian Bale and Matt Damon in the best dad movie of the year.
You sound so excited. I actually surprised myself by enjoying this. It's not really my cuppa, you know, but for what it was, like, whenever I enjoy something that is clearly I'm not the target audience for, I think that's going to go over really well.
Yeah, I mean, it plays. It's 2.5 hours in. It was so funny the day I scheduled that screening. Right before we left, I looked at IMDb and it said 2.5 hours, and I'm like, if I had known, I wouldn't have scheduled it for a Friday night. I'm like, there goes my Friday. But, you know, it was fine.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know the story. I'm, like, confessing that I'm not great with history.
Well, it's really a very obscure history. I mean, unless you are into race cars, I don't think anybody knows this story.
No, I mean, it must have been a big story in, like, oh, I guess it was the 60s, right?
Yeah.
So before our time. But my dad was super, super into cars, and he was an engineer for Ford. And he was constantly talking about, you know, races, big into Indianapolis 500 and all that stuff. So I'm surprised I didn't know this, or maybe I just didn't clock that I had heard pieces of this story before.
So what is the story, Nathaniel?
So the story is about the 1966 race at Le Mans. It's a race that the Italians always won, and then Henry Ford II gets it in his head that he wants Ford to win.
Because he called him fat.
Little backstory for you. Little, like, origin story of this race. Yeah, I love how movies always reduce these complicated things into, like, one little incident. But anyway, so he hires a former race car driver, Matt Damon, and then Matt Damon hires a current race car driver, Christian Bale, and together they team up to try to win this race. I'm making it sound bad. I'm sorry. It's enjoyable. It's a good movie.
So I'll tell you an anecdote about one of the, like, in the first half hour, there is a scene where, of course, Christian Bale is playing this eccentric genius who is socially awkward and has to fight with everybody, but that's just because he's such a genius. So there is this, like, a trope, a stereotype, lots of that in this movie. So, there is this scene where he goes with, and he's having a fight with this administrator who found, like, an error in his car, and so he won't allow him to race. And Christian is just growing so big, and he's gonna hit this man or maybe not hit him. And they're looking at him, the people who might hire him, you know, have this outburst. And, of course, they're like, he's a genius, but he's, like, difficult, and are they going to hire him?
He's rogue. He goes rogue.
Yeah, and I just looked at Philip, and I was like, I'm so bored already. Like, I could tell all the beats of this movie. But the surprise twist is that I think that was a low moment in the movie, because that moment is just so obvious, and we've seen it so many times.
Yeah.
But it gets better than that.
Yeah, and also the trope of the great man who is difficult.
Yeah.
But you have to excuse all his problematic behavior because he's a genius. That is a little tired, but I think the movie recovers from that. I agree that that's a lower point. And I did like that it didn't go with all the tropes. Like, for example, Christian Bale's eccentric genius is a father also, and yet he was not portrayed at all as, like, a distant or uncaring father. So there wasn't, like, that business that's often in man movies, you know.
Yes. Also, they tried to give, you know, there is a supportive wife, and It is the supportive live role.
Yeah.
She is just there to be supportive. But also her big scene, I like what they did there. Instead of just having her be at home doing what, you know, what Emma Thompson says about, don't go do that brave thing, you great man. I mean, she does say that, but they put that scene actually in a car with her driving dangerously. So she was in the driver's seat in that scene while saying the same thing that every other wife in every other movie has said. So at least it was said differently.
Yeah, it gives it a little bit of a verve that wouldn't be there. But I would argue that scene is very overplayed. So it felt a little false to me. Like, I appreciated what they were trying to do, but I think it's pitched so high that, you know, they're scared that you won't realize that we're not just doing the normal supportive wife thing here. You know?
Yeah, totally. But I just appreciated the attempt.
Yeah. But I will say, like, from a technical level, we aren't going to discuss, you know, the tech races other than one of them on this edition of the podcast. But I did think the movie was, pardon the pun, oh God, I can't believe I'm saying it, really firing on all cylinders in terms of the tech work, like the sound, the editing, everything. I was very impressed with.
Yeah,
it really does feel like you're inside the car.
Yeah, it's professional.
Yeah. It's so dismissive, Mortada.
No, I'm not. It is, isn't it?
No, but it's a cut above just professional. It's very good. Like, I wouldn't be sad about Oscar nominations for it in the tech categories.
Yeah, and they're probably going to get them, especially in sound.
Yeah.
And I am assuming because there's cars and cutting between inside the car and outside the car and mm-hmm. into the people in the race, back at home in the U.S. to the wife and child.
Editing is a gimme, yeah.
So editing, yeah.
Editing is a gimme. So what do you think of the performances?
I mean, Christian Bale is a great actor. I have always thought that. But he's just his choices of roles. It's always like I'm never excited by his performance because of just like he's playing Dick Cheney or he's playing this dude. And it's just movies that I'm not interested in. The last performance of his that I really loved was The Fighter because that was a movie that I loved. So he's great because he is good at doing this. Of course, he would do it and he would do it very well. He's very charismatic. And whenever he's on screen, you can't but look at him. And he kind of does blow Matt Damon off the screen a little bit because Matt is just doing Matt Damon, and
with his little gum chewing tick.
Yes. it's the performance to see in this movie.
Yeah, he's very good in it, but I agree that it's like not. I wouldn't rank it among his very best work, but he's really good in it. So I was all about like watching to see if any of the supporting players would pop. And they don't get a lot to do, but there's a lot of people in this movie. Like
a lot of men.
Yeah, a lot of men. John Bernthal, Josh Lucas, who I always love seeing, even though he's always got... No, I'm sorry, I do. But he's always got these terrible... you can't... Our podcast is not a vlog. It's not a vodcast, so you can't see Murtada's face being horrified that I love Josh Lucas, but I do.
Just he in this has, movie, I you know, finish what you're saying, and then I'll say my point about him.
But he always has these, like, he always gets, like, very thankless roles, and this is one of them as well.
It's the worst street.
But I love his face. Yeah. I can't help it. I love his face.
He's the stock villain. His motivations make no sense except as a plot mechanism. It's a terrible part because it's terribly written, and I don't think he does anything with it. John Bernthal also has nothing to do, but he looks good in the suit.
Yeah, everybody looks good in suits in this movie. And I love Tracy Letts, but I mean, Tracy Letts is one of my favorite character actors on the planet, so I just loved him in this.
He loved him. The big comic relief scene, which was funny.
Yeah, he has a good comic relief scene, and plus I just loved his, like, how he would hold the entire scene by not saying anything in a couple moments in the movie, because he's like the boss that everyone's kind of terrified by. I just really loved him in this. So I think people should consider
So what do you think this movie is trying to say? Because the crux of the narrative at the end becomes this sort of these two renegades, if we want to call them that, versus corporate culture. And they have to consider making a compromise to appease the corporation. And then their decision and what they do sort of comes out with a surprise. And so what do you think the movie is trying to say? Is its point about compromise within corporations, or what it's trying to say with that? Because that becomes the main point of the last half hour of the film.
I don't know that I would say that the movie has great meaning, but I would say that it's kind of like a perfect example. This is also why I think it's going to do well with the Oscars. A perfect example of how, maybe not purposefully, but how commerce and art have to work together, which is what Hollywood is constantly struggling with. So I think that will, I think that resonates with people who are in creative professions that also happen to be big business professions.
Yeah.
And it's true that in those situations you have to compromise, but it still takes the artist's side. You know, so it's like it has it both ways, in other words.
It does, which is why to me that was kind of unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Because well, I didn't want it to take the corporate side, obviously, but also it's just like, it's wishy-washy a little bit in how mm-hmm. it resolves it.
Yeah, but that's a good question. It's a good thing to think about. I just think the movie, you notice a lot of like the very positive reviews are very much like they don't make them like this anymore. So it's appealing to that sort of like traditionalist approach to filmmaking, you know, and
but
traditional stories and all that. Yeah, they still make them like that.
They make them like that all the time. Like if you replace the car racing with superhero fighting, it could be a Marvel movie.
Mm.
Like it's the same sort of like, two people come together against the big bad, and there's action, and it's exciting,
yeah.
and it's men, and the women are on the side. Like, it's the same thing with most corporate movies.
Murtada, you're never going to be on movie posters if you keep this up.
Hey,
it's the same thing. Quote, quote, Murtada, the film experience.
Well.
Oh, actually, they might use that. It's the same thing as a superhero movie.
Yeah, I think that's a
they
good
might,
one.
They might use that, actually.
Well, my aim is to get on a poster for an Almodovar movie. I think I'm doing well to get to that.
That is the best goal. Goals.
Yeah.
And you have already been on TV talking about Pain and Glory, so there you go. You're getting very close.
Yes. I'm on my way. Pedro, just wait for me.
Pedro, make another movie is the point. So, do we have anything else to say about Ford v. Ferrari?
I mean, we could talk about its Oscar chances, of course.
Yeah, I think it's across the board here, actually, though I don't think the acting is going to find any traction. I think this is a craft play across the board with Best Picture possibility. And a good possibility for Best Picture.
Because of the box office, because it won the...
Yeah, it's already going to be a hit, and it's got two stars that, you know, are, you know, I was going to say classic Hollywood stars, but I don't mean like the golden age. I mean, like they're very big stars.
Yeah.
So
they've been
like,
stars for like
right,
almost
a long time.
Years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got like stars for the last 20 years and, you know, and a movie that people can respect and that's easy to like, it's not divisive, you know, even people who don't like it are like, eh, you know?
Yeah.
So nobody's going to be fighting against it, you know?
Do you think James Mangold delivering this will help him be considered in director?
Well, as I've said, as I've been saying on the chart, and as I've probably said in an article here and there, I do think he's been working slowly towards the momentum for some big get, like a Best Director nomination, but this, I'm not sure it's going to be this year, but again, he's really working on his momentum. He seems to get closer each time.
Yeah, I mean, if this is a hit, you know, it will definitely help.
Yeah, he could end up there as like the mainstream choice with all these other more auteur-like people in the mix.
Yeah.
So I would say he's the contender, but I wouldn't be predicting him right now.
Okay. And what do you think Christian Bale needs to do to actually be competitive? Is it just a fact that there's just too many men this year in Best Actor?
I mean, I was predicting him up until, you know, very recently. You know, after, like, the Netflix barrage of contenders, I had to be like, okay, maybe that's not happening.
But the Two Popes hasn't come out yet, so we don't really know how the reaction, the full reaction to that will be. We know the reviews from the festivals and so, but it hasn't actually, it's not out yet.
That's true. But I mean, like, the barrage of, like, Dolomite, Irishman, Marriage Story, they're really trying to have 100% of the Best Actor category, which they won't be able to achieve, of course, but it'll be interesting to see how much of the Best Actor category they can hog. And I think it's just not, to your point, like, everybody thinks Christian Bale's a great actor, but I think he needs to, I think to win again, he would need to, like, really challenge himself. And as good as he is in Ford versus Ferrari, I'm not sure anybody would think of it as a challenge.
Yeah, he hasn't shed any new light or done anything he hasn't done before. Yeah, I agree.
So I don't, like, I mean, he could end up there just solely based on the fact that, like, actors just love him, but I just don't think it's going to happen. But I'm in this place with Best Actor. I know that's not the topic of this podcast, but I'm in this place where back to, with Best Actor that I really feel like everyone is kind of on equal footing beyond Adam Driver and Joaquin Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it could go any sorts of ways. Like, so there's about seven people that are all the same level, like Jonathan Pryce, Robert De Niro, Antonio Banderas, Leonardo DiCaprio, Eddie Murphy, Taron Egerton. They're all trying. They're all campaigning, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So Christian Bale, like, everybody's out there. So a lot depends on box office. A lot depends on staying power, like which movies can stay in the conversation. And the Golden Globes, of course. You know, people are always downplaying their effect, but that's why I'm keeping Taron Egerton in the mix, because you know he's getting nominated there. Plus, he's out there trying to get nominated.
Yeah. Yeah, and what the Golden Globe does is that it gives you 10, right? So it gives you double the Oscar. And probably with what the timeline for the Oscars this year, those are the 10 that people will consider.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't have a lot of time to consider this year. So people making their mark already, I think, are going to be at an advantage. That's the only thing I'm worried about the Two Popes. Not worried because I don't, like, love it, but people think Jonathan Pryce is a shoo-in, but he's going to be arriving really late. You know, even though it's been screening, it's not, like, the campaign for it's not as full-blown as The Irishman and Marriage Story. And I think this year, it's all guesswork, of course. I think you really need to have made your mark by now, for the most part.
Yeah.
Because we've got, like, 1 month left, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, Netflix is staggering these movies, which is, of course, the right thing to do. You can't just release them all at the same time. You have to do it one by one. And that's the one they chose to leave to the very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe we should move on since we've already talked about Best Actor recently.
Well, we got to move on to another Netflix guy, right? To Adam Driver.
Oh, that's true. Marriage Story, which I know we both liked, but we are split on how much. I absolutely love it. And you like it.
Yes, I do. It's a very good film, yeah. So it's a story of a marriage or a divorce, and the movie actually starts with the trailer where Adam Driver's avant-garde off-Broadway director and his actress wife, played by Scarlett Johansson, meet with a therapist, and he asks them to write down and read what they like about each other. And that makes the trailer. And from then on, we go to the divorce. So they're separating. She's moving to LA to work on a TV show. He's continuing to live in New York. They decide that they're going to separate with no lawyers and just between the two of them. But then she meets someone on set in LA who tells her, oh, girl, no, you need a lawyer. And so she hires Laura Dern.
Uh-oh. Laura Dern, troublemaker.
Who is this hotshot lawyer and forces poor Adam Driver, who's just so nice and doesn't want to bring in lawyers, to hire the nicest lawyer, but maybe a little bit incompetent, and that's Alan Alda.
Wonderful in the movie.
So lovely. And then once the fight gets ugly and they are on
well,
the
let's not spoil the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can see it in the trailers.
And it's a divorce drama.
Yeah, then that's the only thing I'm going to say. He hires another lawyer, and that's Ray Liotta, who's more on par with Laura Dern. So there you have it, married. And there's a kid, I guess.
I guess. It's like the main focal point of both characters, even though you're right, he is quite sidelined.
Yeah, their main fight is about custody and what, but yeah, the kid is not really a big part of the film.
Yeah, he doesn't get like his Justin Henry moments at all.
No.
Because
the focus is on the two leads,
yeah.
Husband and wife.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is, and I think that's why, you know, well, and plus, Kramer versus Kramer, it gives all the comparisons to that, but Kramer versus Kramer is, of course, like, the most famous divorce movie ever made, so, like, therefore, everything gets compared to it, if it's about divorce. This one doesn't have time to really, like, flesh out the kid character, because, like, if you'll remember, in Kramer versus Kramer, of course, Meryl Streep is absent for most of the movie.
Yeah.
Which is not the case here. Goes back and forth between Adam and Scarlett.
Yeah. And it sort of starts with Scarlett and then moves to Adam. So, like, the first half, she's more at the forefront, and then the second half, it becomes more his story.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you had some issues with feeling that the movie was plainly on his side.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't disagree, but I also don't agree. Because one of the things that I actually found very challenging about the movie, and that I really loved about the movie, is that Scarlett's journey is so sort of inchoate, and her big monologue when she meets with Laura Dern, which is a gorgeous scene, is all about sort of like trying to figure out what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved that her journey was kind of like this very undefined thing. Like, she's trying to find her voice, and then you realize through the monologue that in a way, and not intentionally, he has stifled her voice. Her husband has stifled her voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's a really challenging thing to put over to an audience, because the Adam Driver character is just so nice and kind, and at first you're like, that can't be right. But then the movie slowly shows you that, you know, they're both right, essentially.
Yeah.
So I think I do agree that it is, in the end, it's written by someone who's clearly, like, even though he says it's not autobiographical, everybody believes that it is. So it's still, you know, written by Noah Baumbach. So I think I think you're correct. I just think it's overstated. It's not just you, it's just like a lot of people feel this way about it. But I actually thought it was pretty fascinating how much it tried to see the wife's point of view, and how the wife's point of view was actually harder to understand because it's a person who hasn't found themselves yet.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that it does try to get her point of view, but it also blames her for a lot of things. It blames her for the dissolution of the marriage because he didn't want to get divorced. It blames her for making the fight ugly because she's the one who brought in Laura Dern first.
Mm-hmm.
It blames her for using, they both in the end up using their intimate knowledge of each other to fight in court, but she does that first.
Does she?
Yeah. And sort of like the running joke, even the running joke in the movie, which is New York versus LA, and New York is better and LA is just shit. It's like, why do you want to live in LA? There's nothing there, which is funny. It's a funny running joke, but also it's a joke at her expense because she's the one who wants to live in LA. So anyway, I just thought that, and then by the end, like, if you look at, she gets a big scene, right? Absolutely. He gets two. So that's double. Like, most of the scenes are, they're in them together, but a showcase scene, Scarlett gets one and Adam gets two. So it's not really equal. And I like your point of view about that. You know, it's maybe harder to get her point of view and it's trying to sort of let us dig deeper. But I also think that in the end, maybe it doesn't really get why she made the choices that she is. Yes, the movie sort of tells us that she's discovering herself as she goes along, which is something that it's really great to look, and Scarlett plays it so well. But at the end, I don't feel like I understood where she's coming from. And maybe that is maybe an unfair expectation to put on this film, because it's obviously autobiographical and he doesn't know anything on the other part. So it's an unfair comparison. And maybe the reason that this movie is, people are talking about this, is that the marketing presented it as an equal, but the movie isn't. Yeah. So it's not a fault of the movie. It's maybe more a fault of the marketing. And also the title.
I know Marriage Story is more appealing than Divorce Story. I again, about the marketing and the double trailer, I want to go back to this for a second because it is the opening scene in the movie. And I think that opening is such utter perfection because it grants the whole thing so much intimacy, like right from the go, and you're in love with both characters right at the beginning because it's such a warm way to open the movie.
And it's bookended well too. At the end, you go back to it.
Yes. And I was just so impressed with the opening, and I was I would say that maybe it's the opening scene this year that I was most already in love with the movie before the movie had even really started. And I wish, because they used it as the trailer, I kind of, this is my fantasy, right? I wish movie studios, like the marketing teams, would be like, you're only allowed to use footage from the first half hour of a movie on marketing. And I would love to see if that would eventually bleed into creative teams. And they would be like, you know what? We have to impress you near the beginning because you want to stay with us for 2 hours.
Yeah. I mean, that
it seems like so many movies take so long to get going.
Yeah. I mean, that's what David Fincher did with Gone Girl. He controlled the marketing and it was, you can't use anything after the big reveal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's the best opening scene of the year.
It is a very great scene. My favorite thing about this movie is all the little things that happen that sort of tells you about the intimacy of marriage. Like, there is a scene where they're in the... It's a throwaway moment. There is a scene where they're in the lawyer's offices and they have to break for lunch and Adam Driver is flummoxed and can't order for him because I guess he hasn't done it in a decade for himself, and Scarlett just takes it and orders for him and his perfect lunch, and it just sort of that moment sort of builds there are many like that moments like
that shows you the
intimacy. Like, we don't want to give them all away, but there are several like that that shows you the intimacy of marriage, of people cohabiting for a decade and how they know each other well and they don't need to speak. And that's, it's in the screenplay, it's in the performances, it's done really well, and especially when they flip the coin and start using those things against each other, it's also showing you how intimacy can become rancid. It's so well done that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm besotted with this movie, basically. So yes, it is one of my best picture nominees for the year. I'm not even going to pretend to not reveal that it's in my lineup. Is my top five.
Yeah, and Scarlett is amazing. I've never been a huge fan of her, but I think this is her best performance, and she's Because she has, I think, less to work with, her moments are more controlled, more precise. A lot of it is in those small moments, like when she's looking at her mom, telling her mom that she can't be friends with her ex because they're getting divorced, and just the look, the tension in the voice as she says those, it's just, she's so great at this film. And she has a lot of those moments throughout.
Yeah, and speaking of, like, little things about the movie, I mean, this movie is just so filled with so many, like, great details, but Scarlett's family is so great. Their scenes in this movie, too. Merritt Weaver plays her sister, and Julie Haggerty is her mom, and, everyone in this movie is just lovely, and I think the SAG Ensemble nomination better happen, and I could even see them winning.
Yeah, they're all very good. But who's better than Alan Alda? No one. He is so funny.
So warm.
It's funny. It's warm. And I think I said this before, but I'll repeat it because I think that's why his performance stands out. Everybody is big and sharp, and, you know, they have all these big emotions and negative emotions. That's mostly Laura Dern's part. But even Adam and Scarlett have to play where they get to, like, they hate each other. But Alan Alda is just this warm oasis in the center of this movie where so many negative things are going on. And even though he is a lawyer and trying to get the best for his client, he's a little incompetent, but he's so lovely, so warm. And just the way he grounds the films in this warmth, I think, really makes him stand out.
Yeah, and I think people are underestimating him, including Netflix. I want to point this out in the supporting actor race. I don't think Netflix is pushing him enough. But I think people are underestimating him nonetheless because he's like a beloved figure in Hollywood. And he's so, so good in the movie. And on the campaign trail, I was lucky enough to go to a little luncheon for Marriage Story a week or so ago. And he is so hilarious in person. Like, he had, like, the whole room in stitches, like, when they were doing their little, like, talk to the crowd.
Yeah.
Like when Laura Dern was talking about her body language as her lawyer. And so she was going to this big thing about how, like, so many of her choices, like, it was actually kind of interesting because she was giving Noah Baumbach so much credit for her performance, which, you know, you always expect actors to play up a little bit, like, what they brought to the role. But she said even the way she, like, tucked her leg under her body when she sat down on the couch to be more, like, familial with Scarlett in that scene was in the script. And so Noah was even talking to her about how to sit down next to Scarlett, which she loved because she loved exploring the body language of this character. And then it gets to Alan about, like, how did you prepare? And he's like, well, I ignored Noah's advice because he's like, he also wanted me to tuck my legs under me as I sat down. I mean, he just was so funny all the time and people were just like roaring with laughter. And yeah, he was just wonderful. And he's as good on the campaign trail as he is in the movie, which is saying a lot.
Yeah. He's really good. Everybody's good. Laura Dern is great. And
yeah,
at my screening in a festival, critic screening, this never happens. People clapped after her big monologue. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's wonderful to see it first chance you get. It is on screens in New York and L.A., and of course it'll be on Netflix fairly soon. It really deserves a big screen, but what are you going to do?
And we haven't talked about Adam Driver. He's great. I love Scarlett more, but Adam Driver is great. He gets to play so much because there is a big scene that I think is my favorite scene for him because I won't tell you which scene it is, but he has a lot of physical comedy in that scene, and it's not the movie that you expect somebody to do physical comedy, but that's how great this part is, that he gets to play all colors of emotion and all sorts of things. He sings, he does physical comedy, he's obviously emoting, he's going high, he's going low, he's on screen for most of the film. It's a great performance and showcase for him, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the role is so rich, and the fact that he like makes use of, you know, the return on investment is huge. Like he got one of the best parts written mm-hmm. and then he excelled in every moment. I would be so happy if he won the Oscar for this. Yeah, he has one scene. I'm not going to go into details about scenes either, because I want you to discover this for yourselves. But he has one scene where it's a very upsetting scene where I may have said this already. I feel like I've said this already, where I was actually worried for him as a person. Like the scene became so real to me that I actually started worrying about Adam Driver's like being too vulnerable, like being like too wounded, like, you know.
You were fearing for his emotional well-being.
Yes, because it was just so raw and like, but not in a showboaty way, I didn't feel. And I was just extremely impressed with him. I mean, I've always thought he was a very good actor, but this is like next level.
Yeah.
So we have one.
I agree.
We have one more movie, one more new movie, Honey Boy. Speaking of people being vulnerable,
Shia LaBeouf is playing his dad.
Yeah. So if you haven't yet heard, which I assume you have, it's only in limited release, but it's expanding this weekend. Honey Boy is a confessional, autobiographical, well, biographical type of picture in which Shia LaBeouf wrote it and stars in it as a version of his own father. So it's sort of his life story, even though names are changed, mm-hmm. About his experience as a famous child actor with an alcoholic parent and sort of absent parents emotionally. And it's directed by Alma Harrell, or maybe I'm saying her last name right. Maybe you can help me.
I think you're saying it correct.
Okay.
Maybe Harrell.
Harrell, yeah. Anyway, it's very sort of intimate. It felt, I wrote this on Twitter, but it felt like both an exorcism and an embrace simultaneously of his parents or his father, which I think is like a tricky thing to do and also a very vulnerable thing to do in front of everyone. anybody who sees this movie. So I found it moving and really interesting. I did feel a little bit like maybe it's more rewarding for Shia than it might be for audiences, mm-hmm. but I really liked it.
Yeah, I liked it too. And it's a little shaggy, and it dips sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. it didn't always engage me at all times. But it is, like, it's a unique story because in the way that it presents itself. I mean, we've seen sort of like child actors before, you know, Judy Garland, or, mm-hmm. you know, we've seen those things. But sort of the point of view in this is a little different. It's more intimate. It's not about the highlights of being a child actor. It's about what's happening to you when you're not on set. So, mm-hmm. you know, the little things that we never see, like how do you get from set to set? Who goes with you? What are they doing when you're acting? How do you prepare when you're 12 to be an actor? Who helps you? Who coaches you? Mm-hmm. All these things. And sort of the big narrative starts is, of course, you know, when you're earning, you're the honey boy, you're the person earning. Mm-hmm. What is the dynamic between you and your father in that when you're basically paying him to be your gopher? So,
yeah, that scene, which has been used a lot to promote the movie, that or at least the people reference a lot, is very heart wrenching. Mm-hmm. When Noah Jupe, who's playing the young Shia LaBeouf, says, you know, you wouldn't be here if I didn't pay you. You know, when his father's complaining about how do you think it feels to be paid by your own son?
Yeah.
And that scene is just wrenching. Oh, the hurt.
It does. I don't think it's very successful in the framing device, which is the older adult Shia played by Lucas Hedges. He's in rehab and he's basically writing the screenplay, mm-hmm. which is what happened to Shia.
Yes.
Those scenes are expected, obvious, nothing surprising in them. Although the opening is amazing.
Yes.
This is where I think the director really shows her strengths, because the opening is, his name is Otis in the movie, the Shia character. And this is a part played by Lucas Hedges. So he's in a movie set. It's kind of like,
Transformers-ish.
Transformers-ish. And it sort of shows you a day on set and how it leads to disaster at the end. And it's cut so, rapidly, and you just go, it's cutting from on set in your trailer to what you're doing after to driving. It's so well done, so well edited. It's like a short movie within the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, if that was a movie, I'll say, give it the short film Oscar right now. So good.
Yeah, and I love maybe they're obvious, but I love the visual parallels between, like, the older Otis and the younger Otis in terms of, like, the scene work. Mm-hmm. But I agree that the Lucas Hedges parts of the movie are the weakest part of the movie, even though I do want to say Laura San Giacomo plays his therapist. And I thought she was
so happy to see her.
She was really good. Yeah. I thought she was really good in that role. But those scenes don't, because you do expect them, and it's also, I feel bad saying this, but I think I'm experiencing a little Lucas Hedges fatigue.
I was there last year, but you were not. Welcome to D Club.
Like, I really liked him in Waves this year, which we can talk about next week. But he's just in everything, and I'm kind of like, I don't need to see you in every movie.
And he's not magnetic. He's just not. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so, and I just felt like this felt like a little bit of a stretch for him. Like, I'm sure that's why he wanted to do it, because, you know, he's been playing, like, more sensitive,
mm-hmm.
like, type of characters, and this is very sort of an angry character, so I get why he did it. I just don't see it as successful.
Yeah.
And also, he looks nothing like Noah Jupe, so that's kind of like...
Or Shia,
right? And of course, everybody already knows, I think Noah Jupe is the best child actor on the planet right now. So, like, I loved his performance.
He's very good in this. Although, I thought in Ford v. Ferrari, he was saddled with another sort of just like, we need to explain the map of Le Mans. So, Noah Jupe, can you ask your dad about the race? Kind of terrible scene. I do not like the screenplay for Ford v. Ferrari. It's so formula, so terrible. But, you know, we're not talking about that, so let's go.
Oh, it'll be nominated there, because there's no competition in adapted screenplay.
They need to look out. I mean, do writers not recognize bad writing? Like, what?
Yeah, he's another one. He's cast in everything. Like, he's played now Matt Damon's son, Christian Bale's son, who else's son? Shia LaBeouf's son. Like, he's already... Emily Blunt's son. He's, like, racking up the movie stars that he's
Julianne
played.
Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
Was he her son? Yes. And I never saw that movie, the George Clooney movie, but I'm not sure if he was her son or just Matt Damon.
I think both.
Okay.
But anyway, agreed on Ford v. Ferrari. It's kind of like a not that interesting of a role that he's saddled with there.
Yeah.
It's like a exposition role.
Totally.
But he's like, he gets to do the full emotional stuff in Honey Boy. He's just really good. And I loved the scenes between him and, like, random characters in the sort of motel that they live at.
Mm-hmm.
Because I liked that those scenes were very hard to read. And I give this to Alma Harrell, actually, the director, as opposed to the screenplay. These characters that you don't really get to know,
mm-hmm.
the textures in those scenes were so interesting to me. And, like, it allows your mind to sort of wander to what is this kid really feeling? What is really happening between these people? And I really like that sort of ambiguity of those scenes.
Yeah, I think the direction is definitely better than the screenplay. And I'm very excited to see what else she's going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a director to watch out for. It's actually been a good year for female directors, even though the Oscars probably won't show that. But we've had quite a few really good movies by female directors this year. Lulu Wang's Farewell, Mariel Heller, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And then, of course, coming up, we have Greta Gerwig and Little Women. Yeah. Lorraine Scafaria with Hustlers. And I think Alma Harrell is maybe getting a little lost in that shuffle, but I was very impressed with what she did here.
Yeah, she is. Like, you know, I just talked about that opening. So great.
Yeah.
So Shy is really pressing the flesh.
He really is.
Campaigning. Where did you see him in the Oscar? Is he, because he has two categories, screenplay and supporting actor.
I think it's a long shot for both. Screenplay is nigh to impossible this year, I think, because now even Two Popes has moved into original, even though it is sort of an adapted screenplay. So original, there's like 12 major contenders. So I can't see that happening, but I could see a supporting actor not happening.
Is this, maybe he'll get in the spirits or something, and that will...
Or SAG, maybe. Yeah. I think he'll get something. And I think doing wonders for the perception of him, which is the whole point of, like... Mm-hmm. Of like sort of reevaluating your career and trying something completely different, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it'll really help. I think the next few years could be rich for him, because he is actually, I've always thought he was a really good actor.
And he's good in this film. And yeah. It's not easy to sort of like, quote unquote, do your dad.
Yeah. It is kind of a leading role, but we'll let it slide because, you know, He's not in all the scenes. And the lead is sort of bifurcated between two people, so.
Do you think it will contend for costumes?
What a segue. No.
So what will contend for costume design this year?
But before we wrap up, you've heard our thoughts on those three movies that are all playing in cinemas near you. So we wanted to talk about one Oscar category, as we are wont to do. So Murtada chose costumes. There's a lot of options here. So before we get into it, what's something you're rooting for?
Hustlers.
Yeah. You stole my answer. Damn you.
Sorry. And I'm also rooting for, I mean, that one you shouldn't root because it's a big movie, but I really love the costumes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And although that one is more of a kind of a lock. So.
Yeah. Well, except for no Tarantino movie, including Inglourious Basterds, has ever been up for costume design.
Trivia.
Hustlers, they never or rarely nominate contemporary pieces, and even though it's slightly period, that still counts as contemporary because it's only like, what, 10 years ago?
I mean, any movie that costumes Jennifer Lopez in that juicy couture tracksuit that she's arrested in, which tells you exactly what year this movie happened, and it's also exactly the kind of thing that character would wear. It's perfection.
And her entrance outfit and the ways that outfit changes during the scene just based on how she's wearing it. I mean, the costume work in that movie is freaking amazing. So if they want to ever look at contemporary movies, which they should, Hustlers should definitely be one of the ones.
Yeah, and I've never heard of this costume designer, Mitchell Travers.
I believe he's new, actually.
Oh, okay.
But I don't want to clickety-click while we're talking to look it up, but I believe he's new. And worth noting, just because it's just an interesting tidbit, he's, I think, the only male department head on this movie, because one of the great things about Hustlers and its success this year is it's very female-driven, not just the characters, but like behind the scenes, department heads, everything.
Yeah, I think before this, he was an assistant on Ocean's 8, so that's...
Oh, okay, cool. And they had great costumes, too.
Mm-hmm.
So Mitchell Travers, name to watch out for. I thought he did amazing work. And not just, I mean, J-Lo is obviously the focal point for how good the costumes are, but really across the board. Yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody's accustomed so well. And you know, my favorite thing about it is just the historical accuracy of exactly when those, and maybe this is because I remember that time, like you know, you remember what people were wearing, and it just gets it right.
Yeah. Including even the douchey suits.
Everything. Everybody is just in the right costume, which also tells you what year the movie's set on. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's great, great work. And not just for the accuracy, but just like the creativity, the color, just love the costumes. And I'm also, you already mentioned it, I'm also rooting for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I would like that statistic that Tarantino movies can't get nominated in costume design to end because they already deserve to be nominated for Kill Bill and...
That's so surprising.
Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah.
But I love the costumes in Once Upon a Time in America. I love them. And I loved what Ariana Phillips, who's one of my favorite costume designers, she works with Madonna all the time. Mm-hmm. So I've loved her even before she was a movie costume designer. I love what she was doing with even like the Manson family. She talked about how like her aim was to show that they were really like really off the grid and not in any way like glamorize them, that they were all very, very young and just like dirty clothes, like barefoot. And like, I think, and then the movie stars are like so put together, except for Leonardo DiCaprio, which I think is perfect because he's like always kind of a mess. I love the costumes in that one too.
So I'm just looking at your chart. So you have Little Women, Harriet, Once Upon a Time, Jojo Rabbit, Dolomite, My Name, which all, these are your top five, which all seem like the right choices. And then right below you have Rocket Man, 1917. But there are two movies that are not in your top 10, and I'm very surprised. One of them is not even on your chart at all, or at least I can't find it. Judy, which is huge in Best Actress, so you know they're going to watch it. So, yeah. And it is costumes that are recognizable that, you know, people can make the link, and that always something that people will be like, yeah, let's nominate that. They recreated the costumes, right? And then the other one is, where is The Irishman? I know it's a lot of suits, but it's a 3.5-hour movie, and there is work over 3 decades in that movie in getting it right, and Sandy Powell, you know, favorite of the category.
Yeah, and Christopher Peterson, her regular assistant, I believe, is leveled up to co-costume designer on that particular movie. So I think what I'm guessing, I'm sure it was time for him to level up, but what I'm guessing is that she was only on part of the movie, because she has a huge, busy schedule, too.
Yeah.
No, they're both on that chart, but they're way back in tier 3.
Oh, okay.
But this chart needs to be updated. I'm doing the updates this weekend for those who are curious. I will move Judy up. I'm not sure about The Irishman. I just think there's too, the lack of female characters, I think, will work against it in that particular category.
Mm.
And if they're going with a all-male movie, I kind of hope they'll look at Ford v. Ferrari. Just because, like, I love Daniel Orlandi's work in general, and it's ridiculous to me that he's never been nominated. And so if you want a movie with great suits, I think that movie would qualify. But I'm also, Julianne Day, who did Rocketman, has also never been nominated. Mm. And obviously those are very, like, showy.
Yeah.
But Oscar's a little hard to predict when it comes to showy. Like, Rocketman and Dolomite Is My Name both scream, like, costumes! But it doesn't necessarily mean they'll be nominated, you know?
Yeah. I think Rosie Carter probably will, just because, you know, short memory illness. They will just be like, oh, yeah, she just won. Let's just give her
one. Fresh off her win. Yeah.
Not that she's not deserving. She's very deserving. The costumes in Dolomite are amazing, and they pop, and they're beautiful and everything. She's deserving. But sometimes that's not just the only thing.
Yeah. So the only one of that top five, which needs to be updated, that I don't really have faith in, but I don't know what to replace it. I don't really know what's going to, like, I think there's going to be one expected choice, and I'm not sure Jojo Rabbit will actually make it.
Mm.
But I think the other four feel, like, pretty safe to me. Little Women, Harriet, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Dolomite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But like I was saying with Best Actor, charts and predictions never really show this, but the reason I do them in tiers is because I really feel that that's the way campaigns operate, or that's the way buzz operates. There's always like a, and it, and really it would be more like a pyramid if you did it correctly. It just wouldn't look very good online. the top couple movies, and then it would wider with each tier, and they're all kind of in the same realm of possibility, you know.
And then it's so just, it depends on what they do to distinguish themselves as yes, the days go by.
Exactly. Is there anything you hope doesn't get nominated for costumes?
I mean, that's mean a little bit.
No,
vote,
that is
to
mean.
Vote against someone.
Well, I'm just going to say Aladdin because I really do love Michael Wilkinson, but I'm, and I've told him this before that I love his work. but I found it so obnoxious that they put a shirt on Aladdin the whole time. I really did. And then plus it's just all so gaudy looking that I don't know. I wasn't into it. Although I do think it's possible as one of the nominees.
Mm. Yeah, they do like their Disney.
Yeah.
In this category, you know. I mean, Taron Egerton, we both were at this event for him this week, so maybe, because he's not getting nominated for the Oscar, no matter how many events he goes to. But maybe it will...
So harsh. So harsh, truth-telling.
But maybe it will, you know, doing all these events, going, it will go somewhere else for the movie, and to your point, Rocketman has these big costumes, and maybe this is where the reward will happen for it. I mean, Taron is doing great. He's meeting everybody in the Academy, so next time he has a movie like this, he'll be nominated. Like, this is, I think, maybe the people behind him, this is their strategy, is to get him out as much because it's good for his career. Like, the next time he has a big movie, he's not a newcomer. People know him already.
Yeah, and I have said this before on the podcast and on the blog, people really underestimate when they see people campaigning for things that are not possible. They're always like, that's, you know, why are they doing that? I was like, no, it helps. It's all about momentum and these things. And it's all about familiarity, momentum, and perceptions of your career. And if you're regularly like in the discussion, even if it doesn't happen for you, you're more of a prestigious actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good point. That could help. It also, I think it will help, the movie's chances somewhere is that it's Paramount's only Oscar bid this year. Paramount's pretty good at the Oscar game. They just don't have really anything this year. So Rocketman is their ticket.
I mean, this is just one example. Like last year, they also campaigned a lot, for that Emily Blunt movie, A Quiet Place, and they got one nomination. So
they're not on
a very good track right now. I'm not saying what you said is not true. I'm just saying just the last 2 years.
No, it's true. They've had a rough couple of years because they also had trouble with downsizing. But, you know, these things are cyclical. Paramount will come roaring back with some amazing movie soon.
I mean, they just are doing the new Damien Chazelle movie. They just announced they're doing that with Emma Stone and Brad Pitt. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. So that's our discussion this week. We would love to hear your feelings on Marriage Story and Honey Boy in particular, because those movies are so endlessly discussable, no matter what you thought of them. They're rich fodder for interpretation.
I guess, absolutely. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.